Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial.
It's a beautiful day in the name. Hey there. Andrew Horowitz here. You thought it was Mr. Rogers, I bet. Andrew Horowitz here, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. How are you? Just wanted to welcome you to my world, kind of the wonderful world of investing and really being a disciplined investor. A lot of things we try to bring to you on the show is all about discipline, understanding markets, understanding the parameters of how you should hopefully be investing. It doesn't always work out exactly as you like, as we know that the investing world is not always a single direction, as we noticed in last week, as a matter of fact. Craziness going on in China and in Europe has really upset the balance when it comes to the markets. So I thought we'd do is spend a little time on some ideas I have for investing. I'm going to provide you a great list, about 101 stocks or 102 stocks, something like that, that have a very, very significant signal that's coming, an oscillator called the stochastics, which in this market environment has been working very well in that many of the oversold stocks are the ones that are getting bid up because a lot of the traders that are short are getting their, their shorts kicked. When a lot of the traders that are coming in trying to do a short squeeze. Well, we'll talk about that in a second. We also have Harry Dent coming on. And as I mentioned in a couple of shows, we have a lot of people now that have sent in questions or sent in or called in. And I want you to do that too. I want you to be a part of that special 150th episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All you have to do is simply call in 954-828-2977. And for those of you that are running to get your pencils and pens and your iPods or your devices, your Blackberries, I'm going to give it to you again in 1 second, that phone number. All I want you to do, it's very easy. Don't be embarrassed. And if you mess it up, don't worry. We'll kind of figure a way to edit it. So just call in any question you have about a stock, about the economy, about a market condition, about an indicator, whatever it is. Again, that number is 954-828-2977. And we're going to try to give every caller that we use on the show a book, a copy of The Disciplined Investor. For those of you that don't have it, stop again and rush right out to Amazon and get yourself a copy. I'm sure you'll find something there of interest. One of the things that we talk about is screens, and that's exactly what we did for you today. So we're going to get to Harry Dent in a moment to talk about his, I know his book is called The Depression Ahead, The Great Depression Ahead. So he must be talking about depressing ideas and things that are coming up in the markets. We're going to find out about that in a moment. I also want to talk to you about what happened over the last week and some of the things that we talked about. Remember, last week we talked about oil. I mentioned it briefly. I said I'm going to put a chart on the site at the show notes at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And sure enough, did you see what happened? A beautiful rally in oil through the end of the week. As a matter of fact, if you picked up the 2x leveraged oil, you would have made some handsome profits through the week. Oil went from WTI crude went from about 70 to about 74, backed off a little bit, came back, moved around. And that was a lot to do with the dollar. We also, it had to do with the warming weather and the supplies. Although I will say that the supplies that came out, even though they were delayed, did you notice that? Some of the economic numbers like retail sales, which came out looking very good, I must say. I was kind of impressed with those retail sales. But if you look at the numbers that we saw on Friday, these were the Department of Energy numbers versus the numbers we usually see on Tuesday evenings, which is API. And the Department of Energy DOE numbers came out, and it was a major build. Unexpectedly, again, a major build. And that was kind of a little bit of a head-scratcher, because you think that in some of this warmer weather and, you know, I mean the colder weather, you know, you may see a little bit more usage of various oil products. At the same time, you have to realize that for some of the United States, now we're talking about the United States, there was less movement. You had a lot of snow days. Frank, I talked to Frank Curzio this week. He's cursing his neighbor because he got like 3 feet of snow or something ridiculous up in Baltimore. And what did he do? Well, he was shoveling his driveway. He got 4 steps in 4 hours, he told me, while his neighbor next door was just on his merry way, watching him the whole time with his snowblower. And Frank was just so aggravated about that. And he sent me some pictures. Man, there was a lot of snow. So anybody that's out there, I'd love to see some of your cool pictures. Just send them on in to me over at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Couple of things. All right, so we talked about oil, and that was an interesting play. We actually went both ways. We shorted oil. If you follow the indicators that we put out every single Monday morning early, we put a list of about 15 different indicators from McClellan, the McClellan oscillator, all the way through the oil, and we talk about things like the long bond and the S&P, where it's going, support and resistance levels, etc. All technical analysis, all detailed. Teach a good couple of things, maybe about what's happening. If not, maybe just some information about what we think is going on in these markets. So check that out. Indicators that we're watching every Monday on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Let's see, what else? Okay, so that was two things. The third thing is I wanted to share with you the screen that we did. You know, part of the Quanta Funda Techna process, so Quanta is quantitative analysis and fundamental analysis, and then you have the technical analysis, right? So when you look at that, one of the things that we try to look for sometimes is what is working in various market conditions. And in this market condition, which is, I don't know, schizophrenic market condition, would that describe it well? But in this market condition, what we're seeing is that oversold, severely oversold stocks that are then showing a move from a, we'll call it a basing point, are great candidates for a trade, as an example. So what do you want? Okay, we want to see something that's maybe going to move up, maybe going to be squeezed by the longs moving in against the shorts, and at the same time, something that has some good support zone. So we put this list together, and we did it for U.S. stocks, and it came about with, I don't know, about 100, 101 or so different names that are on this list. And the way you can get that is very simple, is you can go simply to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on show notes, for this episode number 148, and go there and you'll have a list. And from, let's see, we have Adobe Systems and Best Buy and Duke Realty, ITT, Cedar Fair. Let's see, I'm just reading this list down here. Iron Mountain, Penn Gaming, QLogic, Schwab, just going through all this. Kellogg's, Kilroy Realty, Logitech, Microsoft, Vulcan Materials, WellPoint. So there's a lot on there. There's ETFs, there's stocks, all based on the U.S., and you have to look at, again, we're going to put I'll put a picture on the site of what I would think would be a textbook case of utilizing stochastics up with baseline. With a baseline, for example, a stock that we see a long-term trend that maybe broke down and now is oversold, but at the same time, the buyers have been there historically. On the chart, we could see a support line. So I'll put a chart up there of an example of that, and then maybe when you look through these and you find a stock that meets that same criteria, it may be something that you want to consider investing in. Realize that I'm not suggesting that you invest in any of these. I'm not suggesting that you do anything more than use this for research. You know, make sure you do all the research that you can, but this is a screen, and then you're going to look at, we're going to skip over fundamental for a minute because we're really just dealing with a trading situation here. And I want you to go then into the technical analysis and see if it has the criteria, find out where that is and what your, basically your sell stop's going to be. So if you have a stock that's trading at 10 and the stochastics are starting to turn up and they're support at, let's say, 950, well, you know that you want to say 950, I'm going to be, or 948, I'm moving out, right? I'm not going to hold it beyond that. This is not a buy and hold situation. Hopefully by now, 150 shows plus into this whole thing, into this story, you know that buy and hold from the long term forever, or buy and hold forever, is not in our repertoire. So I want you to remember that. Check out that, and tell me what you think of it. You know, not every stock on there is going to be good, but But there are going to be some little gems in there that you can find in the right situation that start moving. The other thing that you have to realize is that what's going on right now is that these markets are really being dictated by what's happening with the dollar and in Euroland. Now, let me tell you something. I'm going to give you a two-minute rant on what it's so annoying what's going on there, because we have this little country of Greece, which takes up about, 2% of the overall Euroland GDP. And what's happening there is everything is going haywire. Why? Well, we're hearing from France, we're hearing from Spain, we're hearing from Germany. Everybody's piping in. Spain needs to be quiet for a moment, because Spain, with all due respect to Spain, has severe problems too. Their real estate situation is much worse than any other country probably in the world, maybe next to Dubai from the commercial side. But the residential real estate is a disaster. Compared to ours, it makes it look like a Muppet show, okay? Their real estate is just an absolute unmitigated disaster, and they're piping in saying, hey, the EU stands behind any country out there that's inside the EU, and we're going to support them. Well, no kidding, Spain. Of course you're going to say that, because you know what? You may be the next one in line. Germany says that they're going to come in and support. France is saying, well, hold on a second. We don't know if that's exactly going to be the case. So we have that going on. And then at the same time, we hear rumored by Reuters last week that this deal is a done deal. Germany is stepping in behind. An hour and a half, 2 hours later, this is what's going on with markets. They decline that. They say, Germany says, no. Whoa, we didn't say that. That's not exactly what's going on at all. So we get this kind of gyrations in the market right now, depending on, are we going to save Greece or are we not going to save Greece? Kind of like what happened with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. At the same time, no matter what happens right now, the euro is under severe pressure. Clearly, there'll be some divergence. There'll be some movement up and down on the euro, depending on the various wind, the way it's blowing on the saving of Greece. And then you have all those other countries that we've talked about. The euro has significant problems. As a matter of fact, there's been some discussion of late that has said that there is the possibility that the currency, the euro currency, and the eurozone may have to break up. How do you have individual countries with all their specific needs and economic needs being managed by one giant currency where they have no control over? So you have Greece now that's dictating the action in Germany, which, by the way, came out with very unimpressive numbers on their growth numbers last week. Very unimpressive numbers. There's a clear and present slowdown in the eurozone. No question about that. We stay away from that area. I don't think we have, very small, if any, investment there, because it just makes no sense right now. There's too much going on there that could be a problem. Now, some may think that it's a great time to invest. Invest when everybody's, throwing it in the garbage and it's a good contrarian play. You know what? There's so many other options right now. So many other places that you can invest. Why not go there? In the meantime, Europe has a big problem, and that could affect us. How? Well, if the euro is going to be having, the currency is going to be having severe problems, well, it benefits the dollar. A lot of money comes out of the euro. It goes into the dollar. That's good and that's bad. The good part is that obviously as a country, we want a strong dollar, which is a sign of a strong basic economy. And we have a lot of people that are utilizing the dollar as a core currency. At the same time, it's bad because exports cost a lot more. Travel's cheaper for us, of course, but exports cost a lot more for other countries, and that slows down the economic growth. In addition to that, since oil and other commodities are often linked to the dollar and bought by dollars, that causes a problem. It causes a problem if you're an investor in those. It may be good for me as a driver because it brings down the price of oil and eventually brings down the price of gas, right? But at the same time, it really could be a significant problem for me if I invest in those areas. Now, interestingly, we saw the dollar move up last week against the euro, against some other currencies. And at the same time, areas that you wouldn't expect necessarily to be moving higher did. For example, we have investments in Patriot Coal, in Consol Energy, two coal companies that we like, and they moved up beautifully last week. As a matter of fact, on Friday, when the dollar was very strong against the euro, they moved up in a market that was generally down. And then if you look at the oil positions and the overall weekly move of oil compared to where the dollar was, compared to the dollar value across the globe, generally speaking, oil did much better than you would expect with the dollar moving as it did. But right now, traders are on edge. There are so many things happening. A lot of support in this market right here. And as a matter of fact, our McLellan oscillator turned positive. And that's a good sign for a potential move towards the bullish side. It really was oversold there for a little while, probably about 3 days last week. It finally turned positive and broke through the positive zone. That is good. And if you don't know about the McLellan oscillator, I think we had Tom McLellan on not too long ago. Hopefully we'll get him back. Basically an advanced decline oscillator of the NYSE. It's looking a lot better all of a sudden. Now, we have been quite neutral in our portfolios, and that's been very good for us, actually. We've been basically taking on no risk on our portfolios and had a great couple of weeks. And that's pretty neat. I think that's the way things should be. But I'll tell you something. If we see the movement as we've seen it right now, there is a good chance that we could see a nice little bull run here once this whole European thing kind of cleans up. Even though we have China coming out and trying to slow down their economy, or at least slow down the loans in their economy, I think that we have a great opportunity for a little while. We'll find out a little bit about that and coordinate that with Harry Dent when we talk with him. And maybe that probably would be a good signal for me to shut up for a little while and tune in to Harry Dent and bring him aboard. So you know what? We'll do that right now. Lots to talk about. I'll hopefully have a lot of notes for you. Please do me a favor. Visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I write that for you. I mean, I don't write it only for myself. We put a lot of our research online. That's how we like to do things. But we write that for you. Check it out. We talk about all sorts of things, give you all sorts of ideas. If nothing else, great economic numbers and review, as well as some great charts that I don't think you've seen before if you haven't been there. We'll be right back with Harry Dent on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Let me get this thing dialed in. I think we have him. And here we are with Harry Dent. He's a good friend of mine. We haven't talked to him in a little while, but I thought we'd bring him back because so many of you have asked for him in emails, and I even have a couple questions that were sent in. And I want to talk to him on a little bit of an update because I do spend a lot of time reading his work, his monthly work, as well as his quarterlies. And, of course, his great book, The Great Depression Ahead, is out. It's been out for a while with excellent reviews, and we want to get an update of what's happening in the world, according to Harry Dent. Harry, how are you?
Good. Great to be back, Andrew.
Thanks. So what's going on in the world? I mean, we have what? We have a little bit of currency problems in Europe. We have some geopolitical problems in the Middle East. We have some questionable discussions of what's going on throughout China and their entire GDP numbers. So tell me, in your opinion, kind of what's happening these days.
Well, you know, there's two things. There's those geopolitical problems, which we have a 8.5 year and a 32 to 36 year cycle that would suggest those are going to rise and continue to rise this year. We have, you know, continued worries about defaults in Europe and defaults on mortgage loans and commercial real estate here in the United States, and our indicators suggest that's going to continue to rise despite the recovery. And then on the other hand, we have a recovery that actually keeps coming in stronger than forecast. GDP at 5.7% here recently. Unemployment, jobless claims kind of keep trending down to a level that's consistent with an ending recession and all that sort of stuff. So we've got both going on. And then, of course, the market first went up because it got oversold and, you know, a reaction to the markets pretty much presuming a financial meltdown that didn't end up happening that fully because the government pulled out all stops to stop it. And now we're getting the impact of stimulus. And when it comes down to it, we're kind of saying the same thing we said from the beginning, with the exception that this is lasting a little longer than I would have thought. But hey, we were expecting a bounce in the economy. We were expecting a strong bounce in the stock market. In fact, we said in the first edition of our book that came out late 2008, hey, you know, the Dow's going to go back to at least 9,800 and maybe as high as 11,800, and our best target was 11,000. Well, we got within 3% of that 11,000 target, and our indicators right now, actually, our technical, our short-term indicators, are actually suggesting that we haven't made a top yet and that this bottom's probably going to hold here. And you know, we could be at 11,000 plus in somewhere between early March and early April before this peaks. Now, on the other hand, we still see the same scenario we've seen in our books all along, that this recovery will not last ultimately because of what we call the ticking time bomb.
Mm-hmm.
You've got these rising defaults. You're going to have rising mortgage resets. That means a lot of mortgages are going to come up for resetting to higher interest or principal payments. And that is predictable. That's going to hit July, August, September, October of this year. So that's the ticking time bomb. We've got defaults rising anyway, and then mortgage resets are going to accelerate that. And then, of course, that throws more foreclosures on the market for years to come. So we still see that the real, what we call depression, the real downturn, will hit in the second half of 2010 into mid to late 2012, and it's going to take that long to work out all the defaults and foreclosures that are already kind of due to come into the system,
right?
And that stocks will crash again probably somewhere between April and November of this year, and I still think it's going to be just as big a crash as the first one. The first crash was almost 8,000 Dow points, so we go to 11,000 plus. I think we could end up between 3,000 and 4,000 on the Dow by the end of this year.
That's some serious numbers we're talking about there.
Yeah.
But let me ask, what's the catalyst? Because one of the things that we've done and the research that we've done here is, and I think I've shared some of this with you, but you know, we look at the GDP number that we just saw recently at a 5.7 print for the U.S., and we know that a lot of that was made up from the, I think, about a 3.4% inventory restocking, and that the inventory wasn't going down as much. And it's kind of a double-edged discussion because you wonder, if inventories aren't going down, does that mean people aren't buying and the it's not being passed through? Or is it that, you know, that inventories are being brought back by the manufacturers? Well, every indication we have is that manufacturing has been growing and that we are seeing that side of the inventory restocking cycle happening. But I guess what is interesting is if you look at that and you pull out the inventory, where we're talking about a 2.2, 2.5, depending on what numbers you use, and if you take this even further and you look at the statistical, someone recently said this is a statistical recovery and a statistical exit from the recession, but we're still in a human recession, and that's the big issue when it comes to unemployment. Whether it's 9, 9.5, 10, 10.5, that whatever it is, those numbers are ridiculous, obviously.
Yeah.
And we know that there was another 1.2 million added to the unemployment by the BLS, last week or so. So the problem is that what would be two things? In your wildest dreams, what could be the catalyst to keep us moving forward and not having the correction? And the secondary question is polar opposite. What is going to be the catalyst that finally takes us off the cliff into, in your opinion, you know, the next crash?
Well, what has brought us back from the precipice and what could continue is if the government can keep providing strong stimulus. Now, what the Japanese learned back in the 1990s, remember, they faced a similar scenario with the exception of two things. They didn't owe the rest of the world money. They owed it all to their own consumers and citizens. And secondly, they were having their bubble burst in housing and their demographic downturn with baby boomers when the rest of the world was booming, which means, hey, at least your export industries are still kicking, but they already went through this crisis of baby boom peaking and slowing down and becoming savers and real estate getting ridiculously priced and excess lending and having to kind of deleverage that bubble. And what the Japanese learned is as soon as the government stopped stimulating or tried to pay down any debt because the debts are growing, the economy would go right back down because the truth is, the demographics have peaked. Baby boomers are not going to be spending more in the next decade. They're going to be spending less. And then this stimulus is not going to be spent by them. I mean, short term, you got younger people buying homes with an $8,000 or whatever tax credit.
Exactly.
You know, they bought cash for clunkers with a 45. I mean, how can you resist that?
Right. I tried. I didn't qualify, but I thought, wow, I have this truck.
Yeah,
maybe.
That's right. I didn't either, but I would have. If I'd had a clunker and I could have gotten $4,500 extra for a trade-in, I'd have done it in a second.
Absolutely.
But that's borrowing from the future, and that's not older baby boomers doing that. That's younger echo boomers doing that. And the baby boomers still dominate the spending, and they're going to be saving. So that's going to be working against you. And again, the government has not solved the ultimate problem here, which is excess lending against overvalued assets. The government should be trying to restructure those loans and asset values so that we get to a sustainable growth opportunity again. Now, that's exactly what businesses do. When businesses get in a position in our modern economy where their revenues may be slow, but they've got excess debt and they bet too much and bought too many assets and did all this stuff, they go through Chapter 11. They restructure their debts in line with their assets and their revenues so that they can not go into Chapter 7 and go under. They can sustain themselves. So the government's dealing with the symptoms, just throwing money at it, propping up the banks, giving consumers some irresistible short-term money and subsidies and spending stuff. They can't keep doing that. And again, unlike the Japanese, we owe trillions of dollars to foreign entities and governments. They're financing half of our deficit almost now, and the deficit's going to grow even larger. So we don't have that ability to just borrow forever. And if you're listening to our own citizens today, which I do on the news, I don't pay a lot of attention to politics, but I am listening to what people are worried about this debt. They're worried about its impact on their kids. The Tea Party now seems to have more loyal followers than the Democrats or the Republicans. And I think that we're saying that this, because of the banking crisis, because of these geopolitical problems and banking problems in Europe and everything else, that this is going to start to melt down the economy again by late summer. In fact, we're getting more specific than we usually are on this. We just see these things converging around the late summer when these mortgage resets come back and our geopolitical, our short-term cycle kind of peaks. If foreign investors and governments and the citizens of this country see such a massive stimulus program starting to fail, and this is unprecedented, there's never been anything close to this in history, they're going to say, we're not going to let you do this again.
Right.
You already did this and you failed.
Right, right.
We're not going to let you rack up another $5 or $10 trillion in debt. I mean, because what's going to happen here is the more liberal economists are going to come out and say, well, you know, it would have worked. We just didn't do enough. You know, $3, $4, $5 trillion wasn't enough. And then, of course, the conservative economists are going to say, we were warning you crazy people in the first place. You've gone nuts and you stimulated too much, and all you did was rack up a lot of debt. And see, it didn't work anyway because you can't solve debt, a debt crisis, by adding debt to it.
Right.
So there's going to be this argument, but I think overall, investors and people are going to say, look, you had your shot, you blew it. And then we go into what I call detox, just what the Japanese found. And unfortunately, our economy, if the government does not strongly counter it like it did last time, it's going to melt down just as fast as it did before, because we're in an even worse situation now. There's been more foolish loans made, government-backed. Consumers have bought houses and cars out in the future now that they would have bought, so there's even less demand. I mean, they've only made the situation worse by trying to give the economy a three cups of coffee. Now we're going to be worn out from the three cups of coffee.
Yeah, you know, Harry, I don't get.
So that's the trigger. When it comes back, I think it comes back just as fast and worse than ever.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the solutions that were being thrown at us, I mean, it's like, okay, everybody, don't look at that pile of death and molestation and tragedy to your left. Keep on walking a straight line. Keep on walking a straight line, and we're going to take you out to lunch right here. And, you know, it's like, wait a minute, whoa. I'm not supposed to see any of the bad stuff. I'm just going to live my life like I always did, pretending nothing ever happened behind me. I mean, that's what it is.
Yep.
It's sweeping this, a gigantic broom.
That's right.
Sweeping
just,
it under the carpet.
Have positive thinking, feel good, look straight ahead. That's right. Don't notice all these people dying and all the stuff on the sides of you, and we'll keep going. And, of course, it's... that's not going to work. I mean,
right.
That's a childish solution. And we keep telling people, everybody's in denial. I mean, even us. I mean, we've been bullish for 20 years, and now we bury them. When we first came out, you know, in late 2008 with our book, there was a stronger response because people were feeling like we could move into depression. But now the government's made this huge response. We find that everybody wants to believe it. I mean, the economists, the politicians, the people... They saw how badly the system started to melt down. I mean, when you see the largest banks and insurance companies like AIG like disappearing before your eyes, you're like, holy smokes.
Yeah.
We've never seen this.
Yeah.
And in fact, the last time we saw such a thing was in the last, what we call winter season, in the Great Depression of the early 30s. Banks and major companies just melted down.
Yeah. You know, there's two things now. I want to segue into some Asian discussion for a moment, but I want to ask you something, or I want to mention something, I think. You know, that was only 70 or 80 years ago that happened. And some of the stopgaps and backstops and rules and regulations that were put in place to specifically stop this kind of situation from happening again, it's like somebody lost that rule book a few years ago, whether it was Glass-Steagall, whether it was the issues with margin and lending and loans. I mean, it's probably, you know, the uptick rules. It's probably 10 or 15 things that were just stupidly removed and that added to the problem here. But let's not go into that, because I find that, it's just disgusting, the whole regulatory environment that we're
involved in. It is, but that happens throughout history, Andrew, that people forget, and when things start booming again, people want the boom to continue. All this excess lending and low interest rates and no margin requirements and you know, no money down, it just helped fuel the bubble, and everybody was getting rich off it. Banks were getting rich, regulatory agency, you know, ratings agencies, consumers, businesses, so everybody just said, like, hey, why stop a good thing? And that's how bubbles happen. And you're right, that the regulations afterwards are too late.
Yeah.
The thing is, you can't allow the bubble to get so extreme in the first place. Once a bubble gets extreme, we've studied history, it will deflate. It has to deflate. In fact, you want it to deflate because you don't want to carry all those high asset costs and high debt costs in the future. It'll weigh down your economy, and that's what's happened to the Japanese. They're weighted down forever.
Yeah, and the Japanese situation is very different. For example, let's pick on China for a second. There's a difference between the stimulus that we had, the $700+ billion of stimulus, one, the few hundred billion dollars that George Bush put on, and the cash for clunkers and all the cash for appliances, whatever the exact total is for a moment, that stimulus in the United States versus the $585 billion or so that
China
was in China.
Much bigger,
And what's weird about it is people are wondering, you know, wait a minute, yeah, let's say upwards of, I don't know, let's just call it $1 trillion for the lack of a better calculator. And there's $1 billion that's put in the United States, and there is only 585 over there. They got a 10.7% GDP print recently. They have some inflationary trends, and things are doing much better. What's the difference? And I say two things, and tell me what you think. Number one, bureaucracy. That's a major issue. The second thing is that $585 billion in China, with their way of life, with their standard of living, is not the same as $500 billion giving it to us here.
It's way larger.
It's much larger.
I mean, their economy is, I think, about a quarter the size of ours or something like that, and their standard of living is about a fifth of ours. So, their stimulus is much larger, and I actually feel like China is way overdoing it. They already have a strong growth economy. Okay, sure, it took a hit because of this global downturn in exports, but that this type of stimulus is just going to generate excess capacity there, excess real estate. They have their own real estate bubble now building rapidly now. China's going to go through a big downturn and deleveraging and detox when the world economy slows down again. Their stock market's going to fall more than ours, just like it did last time.
Yeah. I got to tell you, though, the word bubble's being a little overused. Not by you. I'm not citing you in this. I'll cite all of us. Is there something better we can say? Because the whole bubble thing is becoming almost so commoditized, the word it is, that we're all wondering.
How about orgasm? Ever seen Masters and Johnson's orgasm chart? Looks exactly like a stock bubble, a real estate bubble. I mean, it just, when people get excited and enough energy gets behind something, it just grows exponentially until it bursts. And I don't know of a better term, because we've seen bubble after bubble. That's been the theme of our research for almost a decade now. You know, there was the tech bubble that burst, and then the money went into real estate, and that peaked 2005, 2006, but money also went heavily into commodities, and they peaked in 2008. Emerging markets peaked in late 2007. I mean, we've seen bubble after bubble. You just seen a bubble in gold. Gold went up, you know, 5-6 times in the last several years for, you know, no real reason except for, oh my gosh, you know, economy's going to collapse, the dollar's going to collapse, and you get a bubble there. I mean, we've seen bubble after bubble. Low interest rates and strong growth and strong stimulus just fuel bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
And until the whole credit bubble, that it's credit behind all of this, until that whole credit bubble collapses and the government allows it or it's forced to, you're going to continue to see bubbles to some degree or another. And to me, at this point, it's just better to understand that we've seen the greatest real estate and credit bubble in history. I mean, we've seen stock and commodity bubbles like this, but we have not seen a real estate bubble of this magnitude. We've never seen a credit bubble this extensive. The U.S., if you add up all the unfunded liabilities for health care and Social Security and all the private and government debt, I count about $110 trillion in debt, 8 to 9 times GDP. This, in the crash that got us in the Great Depression from excess credit bubble, we had less than 3 times GDP total debt in this country, and no Social Security health care liabilities, and most of them were business debts, not consumer and not financial leverage and institutions. This is really a mammoth credit bubble, and it's the credit bubble that's helped fuel all these other bubbles. When credit's easy, then assets go up. When assets go up, people want to speculate in them, and then they use credit at low cost to leverage those speculations,
mm-hmm.
and everybody wants to retire as a stock flipper, right. a real estate flipper. Nobody's working anymore, right. and then the economy collapses. I mean, right. that's a bubble.
Yeah. So
and
I
bubbles always burst when they get extreme. There's no once they get extreme, it's over.
Just over. So I have a choice of calling, you know, talking about the and writing about the credit bubble, the credit orgasm, the housing orgasm, the China stock market orgasm. I'm going to stay with the bubble discussion. I'm going to stay with that.
Yeah,
you've convinced me I'm staying with bubble. But I have a new I have a new appreciation and a new view of what these things are, though.
But, you know, I mean, we tell people always say, well, people shouldn't go for bubbles. They are irresistible. And
yeah.
that's the way sex is. I mean, reproduction is the most important thing human beings do. And somehow the universe made it very attractive through
right.
orgasms. And that's the way bubbles are. People at first say, oh, this is ridiculous, and oh, this shouldn't be going up so much. But then they watch their neighbors make so much money. Eventually, everybody jumps in. And it's when everybody jumps in that the bubble finally bursts, not only because asset prices are so ridiculous, but because there's nobody left to jump in.
Yeah.
And so the thing collapses. And then
right.
it collapses very rapidly.
Right. So,
bubbles are
irresistible.
Hard to prevent. You can make them less so by not allowing so much credit and lending. And that our government should have done and didn't. But if any asset goes up 20% a year, within 5 years, everybody's going to be piling into it.
It yeah.
is all the warnings do not stop it. Never have.
Hmm. So you have, I've never actually attended one, but I know you have a variety of different seminars that you do because I just got something in the mail from you. So I know it was, I don't know, last week or so, but or it's coming up. Tell me what you do in your seminars.
Yeah, we have a day-and-a-half seminar. The next one's May 2021st in Newport Beach. We call it Demographic School. We're probably going to change that because it's a little broader than that. But we just go through all of our tools, not just the boom and bust and the demographics and generation cycles and the different products and potato chips and motorcycles and all the things we show. But we show all our cycles, you know, commodity cycles, geopolitical cycles, global demographics, regional demographics, you know, where people are migrating. I mean, it takes that long to get people to see the total picture because what we're arguing is demographics is not a factor. It's the factor in our economy. It affects inflation. It affects savings. It affects, you know, so many categories and parts of our economy that you have to kind of take more than the normal hour and a half we give in a normal presentation if we're doing something for the public or something. You have to sit with this for a day and a half and see, oh my gosh, there's very few things it doesn't impact. It impacts crime. I mean, it's just amazing how the aging of population in modern societies is such a pervasive thing. So that's what it's about. So people can really understand that, hey, you can see most of the key economic trends and cycles that are going to impact your life, your business, your family, your investments over the rest of your lifetime. We project out trends 50 years and plus. We project out inflation and deflation and all types of things. And you know, it's amazing how much you can see. Most people assume you can't predict much about the future. We're like, no, the long term is actually pretty darn easy to see. It's the short term gyrations
yeah.
that can come a little sooner than you quick or expect or bottom a little quicker than you think or go a little, the bubble can go a little higher than you would think was possible. That's the most difficult thing in our newsletter. Long term trends, we've always said, hey, this boom would peak between late 2007 at the earliest and early 2010 at the latest. And here we see the first peak in stocks in late 2007, a crash, and a big, strong bear market rally that's likely to go a little higher and peak in early 2010. I mean, right in line with long-term demographic trends. And the government's going to try to stimulate us out of this, and they're just not going to be able to do it because the Japanese already tried. They couldn't stop their economy from sliding with massive stimulus over many years. Because
yeah.
the baby boomers are going to be saving, not spending, no matter what you
sure,
do to them.
Sure. And you know what else, Harry? Here's something I think is interesting on the short term, on the short haul we're talking about here that you can't predict. But it is assumed by everybody, I believe, that number one, nothing fails. Look at what's going on with Greece or whatever's happening with that whole entire area. That's another one of those, hey, don't look, everything's fine. And all of a sudden, we all knew there was gigantic problems over there for the longest time. And everything seemed just hunky-dory over there. And now all of a sudden it's a big issue and they should be thrown out of the EU. But nonetheless, All these different things are starting to come to the fore. And we also know that nothing fails. We also know that no matter what happens, again, theoretically, the government's going to come in and stimulate, right? So they're going to come in and stimulate, and they're going to bring in, you know, I don't know what kind of program. The next thing, maybe it's, you know, cash for couches, whatever it is.
And, yeah, exactly.
You know, whatever it is. And what's going to happen is that we have this. Now, with that in mind, why shouldn't the stock market be on a trajectory just higher and higher and higher? Or is that all assumed already, and has that all been assumed for some time? Yeah. That's the interesting question.
It has been assumed. It is assumed right now. And as soon as there's the least little crack in it, like Greece, the market's down almost 10% in a short period of time. Now, again, we think that's probably not it yet. But it's the same thing as in the bubble with consumers. Banks just kept lending money. People kept investing in housing and stocks and things like that. It was ridiculous. Everybody knew they was overvalued. But they kept lending until it got to a breaking point, and then all of a sudden, no, banks won't lend against this stuff and it starts to fall. It's the same with this debt thing. Government's saying, oh, we'll bail out this, we'll stimulate this, we'll guarantee that. Oh, we'll support the bond markets by buying bonds. We'll keep, you know, we'll bail out Greece. There's a point where the system and investors say, wait a minute, you just broke the camel's back, or whatever they call it. I mean, there's a point where it'll just say, wait a minute, this is, I mean, we're already saying this is ridiculous. We've been saying this for years. We brought up the whole Eastern Europe and Southern and Central Europe issue and the bad debt. They're back in our July issue of 2009 and said, look, Europe may be the next to default. And why is everybody buying euros and Swiss francs? Switzerland has the greatest concentration in banking of any country in the world, and their banks are as bad as ours, lending around the world, and they've got worse debt ratios than we do when you add it up. Why would anybody be buying Swiss francs to protect against this debt crisis? But yet, you know what? People just do it until the cracks come, and next thing you know, there'll be panic in Swiss francs and a panic in the euro, and the U.S. dollar is going to be rising. We already told people, as you know, in early January, get in the dollar, get out of gold, get out of the euros. I mean, it's time to switch directions, because reality is going to hit and the dollar is going to rise, because we're, you know, Europe's in a worse situation than we are demographically. And when you look at total debt exposure, they're not as bad in real estate, but in debt to governments and foreign entities and stuff, they've got a lot more exposure.
Yeah, except for Spain. I mean, they're bad. We have a question that came in from, who is this, Paul? And he said, which I think this is probably, maybe we cover this a little bit, but given the unprecedented amount of new U.S. debt from, I guess, the time that you wrote it in your book, in other words, from the time that the Great Depression ahead came out till now, which is kind of crazy because it wasn't that long ago, but the new amount of debt, does that change your forecasts? And if so, how?
No, I mean, we expected that. We knew the government would have to stimulate heavily. We probably underestimated that a little bit, but we've added about $2 trillion in debt since then. Well, what we keep telling people, and then we've got an updated version of the book, the paperback, that came out in January 1st, and we're saying what people are missing is the increase in the money supply has been about $1 trillion, the increase in government debt's been about $2 trillion, but we are deleveraging massive amounts of private assets and private debt. There's $42 trillion in private debt, not counting the government debt, just private debt. That's going to deleverage, that started to deleverage, will continue to deleverage. We're going to see $20, $25 trillion in debt written off. That's way more than any calculated stimulus program. We've got a graph that shows private debt is deleveraging and declining faster than government debt is growing. So net out of this, you don't get inflation, you get deflation. Mm-hmm. And then what you don't want to happen is what the Japanese largely did. You don't want the government debt to grow enough to almost offset the deleveraging of the private debt. You want to get rid of a lot of excess debt. That's the good part of a difficult cycle. The 1930s, we got rid of massive amounts of private credit, and that set the stage for low real estate prices, low cost of business, low cost of borrowing, and the greatest mass prosperity boom in history to follow. So, I mean, winter follows fall. Fall is when you get bubble booms. Winter is when you clear out all the wreckage and excesses, and you make way for spring. And so we have to go through winter. The government wants to avoid it. It's like a heroin addict that says, you know, knows they're about to die, but it's like, gosh, I'd rather take more heroin than experience the pain of detox. But the truth is, the only rational choice long-term is to go through detox and get it out of your system. We have to get this debt and these bubbles out of our system.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what is the situation in Japan? Why do people still say it's one of the greatest places? I think Barton Biggs, I hope I get this right. I think it was Barton Biggs. He came out saying that, you know, Japan's one of the best. I don't think it was Barton Biggs now that I think about it. But nonetheless, some big mucky muck came out and said, Japan's the next greatest place to invest. It's undervalued, underloved. Oh, it's a great opportunity. And I'm thinking, I'm not kidding. And I'm thinking, there must be something that I've missed all along about this Japan issue, because just from a demographic standpoint, we know that they don't have any catalysts that are going to bring anything new. We know they have a good workforce. We have a new, you know, a decent infrastructure. But at the same time, we know that the entire, I guess, the structure of their economy is pretty much on its last leg. So why would we want to invest there?
No, it's horrible. Their demographics point up a little bit for this next decade, but they still have a lot of deleveraging to go through. They have 2.5 times the ratio of government debt to GDP that the U.S. has. So they got massive amount of debt, and the only thing that saves them there, their interest rates have been low because of high savings, but that is disappearing at the speed of light as they age. So they got massive debt, the most aging population in the world, even more than Southern Europe and Russia. And Japan has only allowed their business sector to deleverage. The government protected consumers and mortgages. They protected financial institutions. So they still have a lot of deleveraging to go through. Here they are 20 years after their peak almost. Their stock market's still down 75%. It was down 80 to 85% at worst. Real estate went down 63%. It's still hugging that bottom. They are deader than a doornail. Now, so somebody could say from a contrarian point of view, oh, they've been down so long, they're so undervalued that they're a good play. The problem is they don't have, as you were saying, any real positive momentum in demographics and technology trends, and an aging population isn't going to help that, because old people don't innovate, and they don't spend money, and they don't have babies.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't like immigrants.
Right, exactly.
So we think Japan is just, for decades to come, it's one of the worst countries. Japan, Russia, and down the road, Italy, Spain, Greece are the fastest, and Eastern Europe, those are the fastest aging areas of the world. And you know what? China's not terribly far behind.
Well, what about Singapore, South Korea, some of those countries? I mean,
those are pretty rapidly aging, too. They've had a very strong run, but some of the few exceptions of emerging countries who have achieved near developed country standards of living, but that only happens in the island nations. China isn't anywhere near our standard of living when you go across the board. Yeah. India is farther away, has the most potential. There's no major emerging country, Brazil, Indonesia, any large country that's not just some little concentrated island banking center that has anywhere near the standard of living of the United States or Europe. Not even close. They're between 5,000 and 10,000 GDP per capita. We're 30,000 plus. It's a huge difference still.
Yeah, but that could still be a good thing, because then they have to grow. Let me ask you this.
Yes.
I have a virtual podcast gun up to your head. Harry Dent. If there's one country out there that meets the high standards of Harry Dent over the next 10 years, starting today, and your research from a demographic standpoint, from a growth standpoint, from a potential, where is it? You got to have something.
Big country, India. Small country, Vietnam. Urbanization is the biggest correlator with rising GDP per capita in emerging countries, and India is still like 33% urban. You can grow until you're about 80. Vietnam is still on the low end of urbanization. They both have strong demographics. India is even stronger. China is close to 50% urbanized, and so has decades of potential from urbanization, but their demographics and workforce age are getting older fast. And so that's going to work against them in 5 or 10 years. So China's going to grow, but if I had to pick one single major country to invest in real estate development, growth, multinational, it would definitely be India, without a question.
Yeah, well, that's good. We have a nice investment there, actually.
And they make good movies, which is a real sign of entrepreneurialism or talent. I mean, it's not easy to make good movies, and Chinese can't make them, and a lot of European countries can't make them. It's the U.S. and India when it comes to movies.
I got to tell you something. I go to this Indian restaurant every once in a while with a friend of mine, and one of the things they do is it's for lunch. They have a buffet, and they have the best channel, the station on. It's like the VH1 or the MTV of India. That's playing there. It is the best. It's a little bit comedic from what they do and all that.
It would be better than anything you would see in Europe outside of England.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to this decoupling idea, there was this concept that, hey, buy, you know, you got a lot of gold bugs out there, buy gold, or anything that's tangible, get out of the dollar. This is a Peter Schiff discussion. You have those that are saying this decoupling, you're going to see the Asia issue do well. We did see that that broke down pretty substantially. You know, when everything falls,
it's going to break down big time this year again. The dollar's going to go up. Almost all stocks and all commodities are going to go down. So these guys are tending to be in euros and Swiss francs, short the dollar, long gold and commodities, and they're going to get creamed, even though they're right about the banking crisis and the economy going down.
And the problem is with that theory, by the way, this is what was really fueling the carry trade for some time, where there was so many shorting the dollar. And there was, as a matter of fact, there was the euro also was being shorted. Last week was a historic high for short position on the euro, which I thought was really interesting, which was obviously time for a short squeeze. Anytime that seems to happen, right? It's kind of a reverse bubble in that way. But, you know, because the herd is moving in that direction. The dollar, I tend to agree with you, by the way, not from the aspect of the dollar being a good investment, but the best alternative. That's how we view it.
Yeah, that's right. The dollar's been bashed down. It's actually 60% down since Reagan, 40% down since late 2001. It's, in other words, we debased the dollar with the incredible credit bubble in the boom, which we had more than anybody else for consumers and that sort of thing. And this deleveraging of a credit will actually support the dollar. We will end up having more deleveraging than most countries, but up until recently, the dollar got overly penalized, and everybody's fleeing to these other currencies. And again, we've been saying for several months, what's so great about the euro? What's so great about the Swiss franc?
Yeah.
Holy smokes. So that was due to change. And even right now, I'd say, okay, the dollar's probably gone close to as far as it's going to go for now. It may back off for a month or so, but I think it's going to go up. And the stock market may rebound and make a slight new high, and then I think it's going to go down. And so that's what we're looking for this year, long the dollar, short stocks, short commodities.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. That's
or just be in cash, and if you're conservative, just sit in cash and let it all happen.
Yeah, because much of the action these days have been this incredible movement back and forth. It's really been, one up, two down, two up, one down. It's been this real choppy movement of Nowhereville. And it could really take you out, because some of the moves on the commodity stocks, commodities, have been very, very tough on those down days. And we're seeing this high volume, which brings us to a much greater level of commitment when it comes to selling. So the dollar now, could you explain for a moment, last month we saw the true devaluation of a currency. We saw in Venezuela the devaluation of their currency, which is the concept of you go to bed at night with a dollar in your pocket, and that dollar is worth only 50 cents when you get up in the morning, pretty much, when they cut it in half. But there's a difference when there's a long-term devaluation or debasement of the currency. Could you kind of go through where the benefit is from a country standpoint and how they can benefit and why they chose to do so, why Chavez chose to do so in Venezuela, and what the effect is for us, because it's almost like a reverse inflation, or it is like inflation, but where our things are worth less, but we don't really feel it on a gradual basis.
Well, I mean, you don't usually see, like you say, super sharp reversals in currencies for major developed countries, because it's always assumed they can get some support and borrow and stuff, but you get these smaller countries and these banana republics and emerging countries, and they go nuts and overstimulate and get overly inflationary and stuff, and then they just run out of credit, and the world turns on them, and bam, they're just they just have to collapse. They don't have any backstop. But, in the United States, this has been a long thing. But you got to realize that in this boom, because of our technology bubble and our lending bubble, like you say, outside of a few countries like Spain and Ireland and England, Canada, most European countries, Asian countries, nobody had the type of lending environment against real estate and the type of credit bubble that we had. So the dollar, even though we were booming and our economy was doing well and we were leading the world, our dollar kept going down. Because when you create so much private credit, you're creating more dollars. And if you create more of something, it's worth less. When we go through this deleveraging, we go the other way. As banks start deleveraging, and once the government has to step aside and can't stimulate anymore, and this process comes back, we're going to destroy a lot of credit, trillions and trillions of credit, and in a matter of a couple of years. And that's going to destroy dollars and paradoxically make them more scarce. In other words, we're saying we're going to destroy more credit faster
right.
than Asia and parts of Europe. And that's going to actually cause the U.S. dollar to go up. And it's going to make our economy sounder again. Destroying credit is a good thing. I mean, what business would you, you know, if you got a, yeah, let's say you're just a normal business and then you got, you know, $1 million worth of sales a year, but you got $1 million in credit lines and loans, you know, and all of a sudden you go through something and you get to forgive 80% of that debt. Boy, wouldn't that make you feel lighter and healthier and increase your cash flow and reduce your expenses? You know, so restructuring of credit kills assets and investors. It kills bondholders and lenders. But for businesses and consumers on the other end, it's a great thing.
Yeah.
Prices of business and cost of living go down. And real estate going down is bad for the aging baby boomers who had bubbled up and they thought they're going to be a retirement. But all of our kids, they're going to come along in the next 5-10 years and buy houses and get married. This is the greatest thing that could ever happen.
Yeah, I have a little bit of trouble understanding and grasping the depression concept. Maybe it's because I haven't lived through it. Maybe I'm not seeing the same data that you're saying. I can see the continuation of a very strong recession here. And I'm not trying to debate you on this, not at all. But it's hard to imagine in such a short period of time from here. Now, let's stop at that point and back up to, you know, September of 2007. And it was relatively in 2008, either September you want to look at. And it was a very relatively short period of time when it took a big crash and there was, you know, really no reason. So it could happen at any given time for any different, you know, reason. There just seems to be a lot more support buying the dip mentality right now. And we are seeing just a touch better economic news. Not across the board, and with the caveat that a lot of the things are being compared to a much easier representation. So when you see a 1 month housing report that shows a 16% reduction of pending home sales or new home sales or whatever it is or new applications, and the next month you see it up 1% and you cheer, well, hold on a second. That's right. From a negative 16%. Let's get our stories in order here. You know, you need to come back, you know, 25% just to get back to where you were the month before.
Exactly.
You know, so it's a real problem comparatively. You know, and again, depending on what particular economic indicator you're looking at and how they're actually looking at it year over year, month over month, or some other seasonality. But I'm having a difficult time understanding the crash mentality. But I do know that there is a convergence, and it's clear that there is a convergence between Europe. And I, by the way, never understood how the euro would be sustained, the actual currency, you know, in terms of the unity value of it, if there was a meltdown of one of the countries and there could be no regulation of their particular environment and their economy because it's all based on one currency. I never got that through my head. I never understood it.
Yeah, it's a tougher concept than what we have. And again, everybody's saying that the dollar's going to be debased and we're going to have to replace it. No, I can tell you, the next year, people are going to be flocking back to the dollar and saying, look, it's still the reserve currency. Now it's going up when everything else is crashing down, including the global economy. And yes, it's much easier for us to manage our currency than a whole bunch of different countries with different policies that as soon as the haves and have-nots split off or the sound and the unsound, now you got a big mess because the sound got to take care of the unsound. Germany's now going to have to like back up Greece's loans. Well, that stinks. At least in the United States, if we're going to support our system, it's our country we're supporting. Germany's got to support Greece, which does them no good.
And the understanding there is they have to do so because if they don't do so, it will hurt them.
They're going to be quicker to say no.
Right.
You know, somewhere they'll do it at first. I mean, like you were saying earlier, every time there's a crisis, the government's always and institutions are always going to step in and say, don't worry, don't panic. We're going to take care of this. We're going to guarantee it. But like we've been saying, this ticking time bomb of loans in Europe and East Europe, this ticking time bomb of mortgage and commercial loans and real estate around the world, this stuff's just going to keep hitting. Most of the loans that have already defaulted in mortgages have not even gone into foreclosure yet. Even if the economy kept growing forever, we would have foreclosures for the next year, and that would keep real estate down. Foreclosures constantly pummel the real estate market and keep it from rising up, even when there's some rising demand. And most of the demand we measure is from speculation. So you can't, once a bubble goes to this extreme, it's going to keep trying to deleverage. It has to deleverage. It's the same thing your body does. If you get something really toxic in your body for whatever reason, you eat some really bad food in Mexico, you're going to get what's called diarrhea. That's just your system saying we got to flush this toxic stuff out as fast as possible or it's going to kill us. And so that's what the system's going to tend to do. And so you have to understand that when bubbles, particularly credit-based bubbles, deflate, you get this rapid meltdown. I mean, oil prices went from $147 to $32 in 4 months. Yep. I have never seen a market go down that fast.
That was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
But again, we've had bubble after bubble, and tech stocks went down 70-some percent in 3 years, and then this is going to happen again. And you've got to be on a, you know, people are, I get a lot of this, like, well, Harry, why are you making such a radical prediction? We're saying, do you understand bubbles? Have you looked at bubbles? When they finally burst or when the government finally loses control, we saw how fast. I mean, in fact, here's another example. I mean, forget stock markets and something. Talk real stuff. $18 trillion in household net worth, mm-hmm. real estate, mm-hmm. stocks, whatever, disappeared in the first crash in less than a year.
Right.
$18 trillion.
Yeah, unbelievable.
That's how fast deleveraging works and deflation works. $18 trillion, that's more than our entire GDP evaporated in wealth like that. That's wealth that will never come back. and assets that people can never spend down or sell or borrow again.
Right.
And again, how can banks recoup when that much assets destroyed? All their loans were made against assets, and those assets are not worth anywhere near what they're worth. And again, people keep expecting real estate to bounce back. I'm like, have you looked at Japan?
Right.
20 years later, and it still hasn't bounced.
And continuing on with
when
your
you get a smaller generation follow a larger one, and you get this level of a credit bubble deflate, it takes a long time to come back.
Yeah. So continuing on with your bodily function analogy, if the diarrhea, seriously, if the diarrhea is there to help us flush out the poison and the toxins and all that, right? I mean, clearly,
it's better to let it happen.
Let it happen, because right now we've stuffed ourselves and become constipated, and we're not letting this whole thing out. So therefore, it's infecting and continuing to cause major problems throughout the system.
So you put you plug your finger in this part of the dike, and then it comes out somewhere else.
Right,
so that's
exactly
what we've been saying for a year. The government's going to stimulate. It's not going to work. It would work if they actually did something to resolve the problem. If they said, look, we're going to lend some money to some banks and institutions, but only if they write down loans and restructure and get this. In other words, we want to help the restructuring, the diarrhea, the deleveraging. We're not just going to throw money at the thing and hope everything goes back to Disneyland and everything's okay again. Everybody's hoping the economy comes back, the Fed can carefully orchestrate this, real estate will then come back, and then the banks don't have to write off all these loans and all these toxic securities don't have to melt down and become really worthless. Well, that is not going to happen. I'll tell anybody today, you want to bet me $1,000, it ain't going to happen.
Yep, I hear you.
Because they let it go too extreme. This debt will find its way into deleveraging one way or the other. We're just looking at a number of things and saying our best guess, and it's a very strong guess, is that we're going to see this meltdown start by August, by July, August, September of this year, and maybe earlier. It's going to start again no matter what the government does.
Yeah, I hear you. So May is your next seminar, and to get in touch with you, they go to hsdent.com. I think that's the best place to probably do that. We'll have that information on our website. Of course, his book, an excellent read, one of the books that he's written, an excellent read, called The Great Depression Ahead. You may have read his other books like The Great Boom Ahead and The Great Bubble Boom. Boom Bubble? What was the other one?
Yeah, The Next Great Bubble Boom.
Bubble Boom. So lots of different and fun things that you get from him, as well as his team writes a wonderful monthly and I believe a quarterly newsletter and has great stuff available for you. So, Harry Dent, I want to thank you so much for joining us and helping us understand some of the horrible things that are going to be happening to us.
Well, you know, Andrew, we've been bullish for 20 years. We're not bearish by nature, but hey, every cycle ends, and this is the time to be cautious, no question.
And you know what? To be very honest with you, and here's the thing I think investors forget. If you're wrong, I mean, let's just get this on the table. If you're wrong, the worst thing is that you didn't make a lot of money right now in this small period of time, let's say. I'm just saying the worst case.
Yeah, and if we're wrong, how much more can the stock market go up in this year after advancing 50, 60, 70% in less than a year?
Right.
I mean, come on, there's not a lot of upside here in any scenario. And we're saying there is a lot of downside if we're right.
I hear you. Harry Dent, thanks so much for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll talk soon.
Okay, thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, buddy. And that's a wrap. That's the Disciplined Investor Podcast for this week. And I wish you a very fine week. Look for that stochastics up, that crossing up screen that we did, and check it out. Make sure to use some research and use some of your disciplines that we have discussed for some time here to make some profits on them. I'd really like you to do so. Find something that makes some sense. If you have questions, you know where to find me. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I want to mention to you also that if you hadn't done so already, you need to listen into DH Unplugged. We do that every Tuesday night, and it issues and publishes on Wednesday. And of course, for those of you that have the desire to learn more about the basics of investing, check out The Winning Investor. All those are available on iTunes. So make sure to check that out and to spend some time learning. I wish you a wonderfully profitable week. For those of you that didn't get it before, the Skype number that call in for the question for the episode number 150 is 954-828-2977. Next week, we have a gentleman that we've had before. His name is Das. We go by first names with him. His last name is a little tough to pronounce. So he is going to talk to us about the Botox economy. How much fun is that going to be? We'll talk to you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz signing off for now. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.